Kids often struggle to know their parents as full-fledged human beings engaged in a world beyond their home. To better understand his deceased sports writer father, author John Jeremiah Sullivan explored the history of horses in his new book, Blood Horses, Notes of a Sports Writer's Son. John Sullivan joins us now from the studios of member station WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, and thanks very much for being with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start underground. One of the ideas you explored in Blood Horses was how Kentucky's limestone is believed to have helped assure its place in horse history. Tell us about that.
This is possibly true. The limestone deposits that underlie central Kentucky are said by geologists to be unusually rich in calcium, and the idea is that this somehow gets leached up through the grass, which is then munched on by the foals, and the theory then goes that it strengthens their bones. I'm not sure anyone's ever done hard science on this, but it's pretty to think so.
Yet the bluegrass of Kentucky, people say, is related to the same species of grass that comes from the steppes of Central Asia, where, of course, the horse was domesticated in the first place. A lot of it's about grass, too, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. It all goes down to the ground.
Are you one of those people who believes that in a certain light, at a certain time of the morning, at a certain time of the year, you can really see a tint of blue in that grass?
I've seen it, but I'm not sure I was in my right mind when it happened, so I don't trust the memory, but people say.
For those of us who've not been to Kentucky, can you describe the unique marriage that the state has with this unique animal, the horse? How is it different from Virginia, for example?
Well, it has everything to do with Virginia, actually, and it owes to a set of interrelated, I guess you'd say, historical contingencies. The Virginians were doing everything they could in the 18th century to be like the English, who were developing the thoroughbred as a breed, and getting more serious about racing and starting to organize the races more carefully in a more systematized way. The Virginians started picking that up, and then when Virginians started moving into the Kentucky region as pioneers, they brought the horses with them, and what they found was this country that was really sort of made for the thoroughbred. It had a lot of naturally occurring open spaces, which Virginia hadn't had. It was easier to clear land for racetracks, and there were plentiful limestone springs which could be used to water the horses, and I think the horse people met horse country at that moment.
Horse racing in this country goes back a long way. You say the first recorded event, I think, was in or around New York somewhere, but it was racing on a flat, a strip, and racing just speed and not that far.
Right, what they called quarter racing, which were these just mad dashes down cleared paths, really nothing like what we would recognize today, although that sort of racing had been going on for a long time. I think it's being recorded in England as early as the first part of the 16th century.
And in Arabia well before that, presumably.
We don't know exactly what kind of racing they had. This question has come up over this new movie, Hidalgo. It's tricky with the history of racing in Arabia, because of course there weren't a lot of written records, so we're dependent on some tall tales, or not necessarily tall tales, but tales.
But one of the things you do write in the book is if every house cat really speaks ancient Egyptian, every horse speaks classical Arabic.
I think so. This is hotly debated, and there are certainly people who know more about the subject than I do, but what I came to the conclusion, reading through a lot of old 18th century English books about the thoroughbred, that the horse was really a fairly, its genome, that is, was pretty thoroughly Arabian at the time when the thoroughbred was first isolated as a breed, and that this notion of the thoroughbred as a horse descended from Arabian stallions and English mares was really more propaganda than anything else, and it developed as the English were becoming interested in seeing themselves as the home and the source of the finest horses, whereas in the past it had been the thing to do to look to Arabia, and English aristocrats are very proud of having acquired animals directly from the Middle East. And this gradually begins to change as England develops its own export economy, selling horses.
And indeed to places like the United States. And one of the things that people were interested in as they cleared more ground and started to develop circular tracks was horses that could run a little bit further than those quarter horses.
Precisely. It's hard to imagine now what an issue that was, finding enough open land to run on. But this, it's interesting in a way that they didn't come across this innovation earlier. But once you develop the circular track, it's completely up to you how long you want the race to be,
and over what sort of surface. And again, you've got all kinds of racing surfaces, from steeplechasers who jump over things, including water and hedges and that sort of thing, to the typical American race, just on dirt.
That's right, and horses are specifically bred to favor one surface over the other.
Your father, who you write about a lot in this book, and your family and your upbringing, this is a history of the horse, its domestication, its relations with us as a species, but it's also about your family and your father. Michael Sullivan was a sports writer, as the title of the book suggests, but covered baseball, among other things, and this could have been one of those any number of father-son baseball books, given the number of hours you spent with him in the press box in a ballpark. Why did it turn out to be about horses?
That was a question I had in the beginning, and I think there's an extent to which the book was an attempt to answer that question. He was known primarily both here in Louisville and in Columbus, Ohio, where we moved to when I started high school. He was known primarily as a baseball writer, so I was taken aback when I had a conversation with him in his hospital room not long before he died and asked him what he remembered from all those years of writing about sports, because I knew he had seen some amazing things and met some amazing athletes, but he didn't hesitate even for a second. He just launched into this very lyrical description of watching Secretariat win the Derby in 1973, and it was clear to me as he spoke that he considered it one of the most beautiful things he'd ever seen, and that turned out to be the last time I ever spoke to him.
I'm going to read this, if you don't mind, from your book. This is your father's description as you put it down. "I was at Secretariat's Derby in 73, the year before you were born. I don't guess you were even conceived yet. That was just beauty, you know. He started in last place, which he tended to do. I was covering the second place horse, which wound up being Sham. It looked like Sham's race going into the last turn, I think. The thing you have to understand is that Sham was fast, beautiful horse. He would have been the Triple Crown in another year, and it just didn't seem like there could be anything faster than that. Everybody was watching him. It was over, more or less. Then, all of a sudden, there was this, like, just a disruption in the corner of your eye, in your peripheral vision, and then before you could make out what it was, here Secretariat came, and then Secretariat had passed him. No one had ever seen anything run like that. A lot of the old guys said the same thing. It was like he was some other animal out there. By the time he got to the Belmont, he was pretty much lapping them."
That's pretty eloquent of the old man.
Not a bad writer. You quote him pretty well.
I later learned from my mother that at that Derby, my father was not in the press box where he was supposed to be. He tended to do this at sporting events. He had dropped in on some friends instead who had seats right next to the track, and he told them before the race went off, "Now I need to get onto the track immediately after they cross the wire." And so as soon as the last horse came across, they all picked him up on their shoulders and sort of threw him onto the track. he was rarely where he was supposed to be.
We're speaking with John Jeremiah Sullivan. His new book is Blood Horses, Notes of a Sports Writer's Son. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Chuck is with us from Modesto, California.
Hi, I have a question on new breeds coming into North America. I understand there's a breed coming in now from North India, a fairly hardy breed. Marathi, I believe is how it's pronounced. Does the author know anything about this breed?
John Sullivan?
I wish I did. Are we saying this is a separate breed or a strain of the thoroughbred?
I believe it's a strain of thoroughbred, and it's quite the horse in North India, and it's being developed here now in the United States.
For what purpose, do you know, Chuck?
It's used for polo, for one thing, in North India, but I understand it also has quite an endurance.
Well, I guess you don't know anything about it, John.
I'd like to know about it.
I'll get a prize for stumping him today.
There you go.
Very good.
If we played Stump the Band, I would lose every time, though, Chuck, I'm afraid.
Good day.
Appreciate it. And one of the things you did in researching your father's life, you know, this book is not a linear history of the horse. It's more of a meditation, a layers built and peeled back. Did you have your father in mind as a reader when you wrote it?
There are places where I did, and it was tricky to write about him in that way, because there's a degree to which the book is an attempt to finish a conversation with him that I felt was sort of cut off prematurely by his death, and I took pains to write about him and to respect his own view of his life, because he wasn't there to keep up his end of the conversation. I didn't want to just co-opt his story. So there is a conversational aspect to it, and I try to signal where I sort of differ with his interpretation of things. But I think he would recognize himself in the description. I hope so, anyway.
As your father, you note that you know, children have a very odd understanding of what it is that their parents do. And as you noted, that late in life, you figured, learned indeed, that your father met a lot of important people, saw a lot of events. Jordan in North Carolina. You talked to Faye Vincent, the former baseball commissioner, about what he had done as a baseball writer. Faye said, oh, he was very fair about the Pete Rose thing. At the time, you didn't even know what it was.
That's right.
And the time that you met Pee Wee Reese in the press box at the ballpark, and in a way almost embarrassed to shake the hand of the great man.
That's true, and it kills me to think about that, because of course there are so many fathers who would love to be able to introduce their baseball playing sons to Pee Wee Reese. But in a way, it was my father's own doing that I was a little bit removed from that world and from what he did. He was not the type to bring work home. He didn't like to talk about it. You know, it's a fairly rough lifestyle in its way. You're on the road a lot of the time, and I think it fosters a lot of unhealthy habits. And when he was home, by and large, he wanted to be away from it. So some of my most cherished childhood memories are the nights when he would just let me sit next to him in the press box after baseball games, and it was a very quiet experience. He, you know, he wasn't into explaining things to me, but I could just watch him work, and I remember that very well.
You did more than just sit next to him. You'd go down on the field and pretend to throw pitches and run the bases.
That's right. The park was sort of mine after hours. He was a beat writer, so he had to stay pretty late. He usually had to file two stories before he went home, so we would be there until very late at night, and it would just be me and some guys who had, you know, hidden away in the restroom until the security guards went home, and then would sort of creep out and finish off people's beers. probably not the most healthy environment for one's son to be growing up in, but I loved it.
There's a peculiar quality in ballparks, this huge throng there just a few hours before that empties out so quickly, and in such a short period of time, it's transformed from this raucous, noisy place, an unending din almost, and then it's just so very different.
It's true, and I realize now looking back that it was at those ballparks that I developed my love for these kind of ancillary spaces at big sporting venues. And this, I love, for instance, the backside at a racetrack, which is so different from the track where the action takes place and where it's noisy and where there's always a sort of bustling crowd. And then as soon as you pass through the gate, you really enter another world, this enclosed pastoral space, which is maintained for the horses. And there's really an otherworldly quality to it, how abrupt that transition is between the two. And there was something of that in those ballparks when you would look down on these thousands of empty seats and the empty field, and it was just silence, you know.
John Jeremiah Sullivan, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
John Jeremiah Sullivan is the author of Blood Horses, Notes of a Sports Writer's Son. He joined us from the studios of member station WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. We were unable to reach Andy Beyer because of cell phone problems. We apologize for that. Ira is here tomorrow. We'll see you Monday. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.